Hey, this is Jamie Brissick, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas, and welcome to another fine edition of Walking the Floor with your host, me, Chris Shiflett. Just like every week, it is beautiful outside. It's a little chilly. I think we're making that transition right now from fall to winter. I don't know when winter officially starts, but it started for me Thursday morning surfing Rincon with what I think was the first little winter swell we got. So that kicks it off. It is officially winter, my friends. Welcome to winter, which is fitting considering my guest today, Mr. Jamie Brissick, who is a former professional surfer turned writer, and I will get to all that in a moment. But first, I gotta tell you, I have one little solo acoustic holiday gig coming up. It has not been announced. It's supporting another band, and that will be in the Southland somewhere. Look for the announcement in the next, I would think, in the next week. Maybe even by the time I post this podcast, it will have been announced. But it hasn't been announced yet, so I can't give you the details. But if you're in the Southland around Christmas time, then, you know, we've got a little something for you coming soon. Solo acoustic gig. Haven't done that in a while, and I'm kind of looking forward to it. I think it'll be fun. All right, let's pay some bills. Did you know that at Zounds.com, you get free shipping on every order? No exceptions and no exclusions. Even crazy heavy items like tube amps, 8x10 cabinets, giant synth boards, subs, drum kits, all the hardware, and larger format mixing consoles that you could imagine ship free at Zounds.com. So get over to Zounds.com, that's ZOUNDS.com, and get all your stuff today just in time for the holidays. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to the interview. I love surfing, and I love good riding, and there aren't many people doing good riding on surfing. And that's one of the things I love about Jamie Brissick, who is a former professional surfer turned writer. He writes a lot about his own experience, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, which is like one of the most fascinating eras of surfing to me. He's written several books and a bunch of articles in the New Yorker and Surfer's Journal, which I'll place some links on my website so you can go check out some of his writing if you're not familiar with it. I tell you, I was listening to an interview with him, I don't know, a year or two ago on another podcast, Surf Splendor. And I had the weirdest experience where I was driving up PCH one day to go surf up in Malibu at a buddy's house. His dad lives on this private beach up there. We surf a lot. And I was listening to this interview with Jamie Brissick, and I had never met him. And I knew his writing a little bit. I think at that time I'd read Becoming Westerly and maybe read The Dazzling Blackness. Or, you know, I'd read a couple of things of his at that point. And I'm listening to him in this interview talking. And I park my car and I put my wetsuit on. I grab my board and I go down and I paddle out. And there's a few guys out, and I'm, you know, I'm just kind of like listening in on the conversation, and it was like the same voice. And then I hear one of my buddy go, "Hey, Jamie," blah blah blah. I said something to him, and I looked at the guy. I'm like, "Hey, are you Jamie Brissick?" And he was like, "Yeah." I go, "I was just listening to an interview with you on a podcast on the drive up here. That is so bizarre." And ever since that day, I've been wanting to bug him and get him in to interview him myself, which I finally did, just on the heels of him putting out a great new book called The Dazzling Blue. That's a collection of his blog entries from the Birdwell blog. I'll put a link to that up on my website too. But that's where this conversation kicks off. This is Jamie Brissick on Walking the Floor. Thank you for bringing your new book.
Yeah.
I loved it. I burned through it.
Cool.
I was curious reading it. Why you chose? Like, what do you? First off, what is that flash nonfiction, or what is that style of writing called?
It's, you know what? It's an interesting one because it's actually turned into something really great for me, and that is, Birdwell Beach Breeches were the first shorts I ever wore as a kid. Before I even found a surfboard. I mean, literally, I think I had a boogie board at the time, but we would play in the beach here in Santa Monica.
Right.
And we wore Birdwells. And so however many years later, 30 plus years later, 40 years later probably, I got contacted by this guy who'd bought Birdwell, Matt Jacobson, and he said, I'm doing Birdwell and we're staying very true to what it's always been, but I would love to have a kind of web presence where there are blog entries, and I'd love to have you write stuff, and you can basically write anything you want. And I thought, cool. And obviously, like, under the parameters of it has to have something to do with sort of the beach and the lifestyle that Birdwell's in. And so two pieces a month, I've been doing it for nearly 6 years, and it's been this great exercise because, and I'm sure you can relate to this as a musician, there are those things. I remember reading about this playwright who made it a mission to write a one-act play every single day for a year, so like 365 plays in 365 days. This sort of producing a couple pieces every month, drawing on memories, finding something interesting in the current events of surfing, just sort of producing content has been a really, really fun thing, and it's sharpened me as a writer. So they're all over the place.
There's something in that about having to finish something.
Yes.
Right? Like, even if it's 2 pages long. Like,
yeah.
Actually, because I've done that as a writing exercise with songwriting myself, where you just wake up and you give yourself half an hour and you have to finish something, and you have to, you know, it has to be a song. It has to be done.
Yeah.
Which, you know, normally for, I don't know what it's like for writing, but for songwriting, you'll just dilly-dally with never finishing that stuff for years, you know?
No, it's so much like that with writing. And I find that the deadline is such an essential thing. And the more, you know, the thing I've come to realize, and I think I've worked on things. I mean, my usual program is like, I've got a bunch of stuff with deadlines that have money attached that I'm working on. Then I'm working on something that's closer to my heart, that's more long form.
Right.
And that's the one where I can sort of prolong it over years, and I can indulge. And I've come to realize that the more there's sort of a deadline, and the more I've just got to get the thing out, actually often it's better. Like, there's an urgency to saying what you need to say and not polishing, and it's probably like overproduced music or something.
Sure.
Like overthought out, right?
Yeah,
there's just like, there's a rawness. And with a gun to your head, sometimes the what comes out of you is your deepest, truest voice. You don't have time or energy. You really don't have like the time to be mannered or to sort of try to make it what you want it to be. It's like, this is how you respond in an emergency situation.
Right.
It's like your truest essence comes out.
And you do that in a super micro style with your Instagram account, right?
Yeah,
is that sort of the same idea?
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of stumbled on, well, here's the thing. I started doing Instagram probably 5-6 years ago, and I was fascinated. I'm fascinated by Instagram, actually. I could talk all day about Instagram. But the one thing I wanted to do was almost use it as a writing experiment. And I had this idea of, like, if you were determined to become a great stand-up comic, like, among the many rites of passage would probably be having like an entire audience just think you're horrible and boo and metaphorically throw tomatoes at you. And I sort of thought, like, it'd be really good to like use Instagram as a medium to actually just practice embarrassing myself, like practice being ridiculous.
Right.
And then sometimes like kind of saturin and sometimes like overly vulnerable and oversharing and all the things that are kind of like, you like, those things can make us like locked up with self-consciousness. And I thought, like, I want to liberate myself and as a result find like a deeper essence in myself. So that's kind of the micro Instagram posts that I do are just efforts to do that.
But do you get, I mean, there's nothing like social media to, you know, you can post, I know, just in my own, I follow you on Instagram and I read your Instagram posts, but I don't read
Thanks.
The comments.
Uh-huh.
So do people, what, you know, do you get tomatoes thrown at you in the comment section on it?
I think I sort of get both. I mean, I've noticed being unfollowed, definitely, but it started that way, and now I think I've just sort of, it's like an interesting way of, it's not that I'm doing it to try to like gain followers or grow the thing. It's
right.
More just like, it's an interesting way of observing what people care about.
Right.
I mean, on a total side note, like, it's really interesting. The way I was raised, what would be considered, and I was raised, my oldest brother passed away, but I was the youngest of three brothers. But we like kept ourselves in check with our egos, and anything of like braggadocio would be just shot down. I don't know if that's a certain era, but I've noticed on social media, it's actually like encouraged to be incredibly self-indulgent.
Sure.
Case in point, you and I are sitting here with microphones, and there's the sense of we look important right now. Or I'm having a moment where you're interviewing me. That would be like an Instagram moment.
Right.
Or being on stage would be an Instagram moment, or doing the fashion shoot from behind the camera, the photographer's head with you. That thing of like, look at me, I'm like the subtext of all of it is I'm fucking important here.
Right.
It's so prevalent in social media, and I don't know why, but it bothers me horribly. Like, right. I hate that that's what life has come to.
Well, it's fun. I mean, I have teenage kids, so I see that. I see how sort of celebrated that is, how different that is from the time that we grew up. I think we're roughly around the same age, whatever. But that's also so different from, like, the surf era that you came up in, like, which I assume was way more sort of whiteboard, black wetsuit, you know, you can't... You know, I'm sure there were like an older crew that was there to humble you at every turn.
That's it. No, that was about understatement, and it was there definitely was. I mean, it's almost embedded, and I'm sure I probably have it from surfing. But it's that period of the 70s where you don't expose your spot, you don't talk about your spot. There was localism, and so yeah, and then it was sort of let your actions speak in the water, and like. I can remember being on the beach when I was 13, 14 years old, where if someone was bragging out about a ride they got, like someone would shut them down very quickly. So there was just this idea of, you know, you do the thing, and yes, we do value doing it well, but it's not like you go boasting about it. And
right.
I think like social media has become a platform to just sort of boast about all of it. I mean, I do it too. I don't pretend that I'm beyond it, but I just, I observe it, and I kind of think like, And hence my desire to occasionally try to embarrass myself on purpose.
Well, I was going to get to this, but I wonder, like, who do you think follows you on social media, and who is reading you? Is it people that know you from surfing? Is it people that know you from writing?
Yeah, kind of.
Because I would imagine you'd get kind of different responses from both.
Yeah, for sure. A combination of both. And I think that it's interesting because there is almost like a polar extremes between those two. I think like... my writer friends might look at it and what I do love, this is the fun part, and this probably relates to songwriting, is I can write like a four sentence post, and the wonderful thing is there's the edit thing. So I go in and it's almost like my little Rubik's Cube that I'll play with for a little bit, and I'll be like, okay, I can eliminate that word there, or that's like that adjective doesn't need to be there, or actually that sentence would go before this. And it's this like little writing exercise. I don't try to spend too much time there because I've got writing I've actually got to do that's, you know, for publication and important, but it's almost like this little experiment of messing with the thing. But I think to answer your question, like my friends who are writers would probably be observing it. I mean, obviously it's like more of a visual medium, but if they're reading the caption, it would be like, okay, well, what is that prose like? And what are you doing basically? And like the sentiment, I guess, or the idea behind it. And then my surfer friends would be more, I think a lot of that it's weirder in the surf environment because it's just a different thing. It's like when I started writing and I got into reading literature, what appealed to me so much was I don't have these conversations with the people I know. It's sort of like there was like an ability to sort of examine life or parse life that I certainly didn't find in the Malibu parking lot, but I did in the books that my dad handed me at a young age. And I would read these great writers and they would get into the minutiae of how things feel and what's going on. And I, at the time, I still lack the words to describe it, but it was like, oh, there's this thing that I'm craving, which is just observing more, I guess.
Right, a deeper reflection.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you think you're viewed from the surf world versus the literary world, and which one's sort of more important to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a time when I first started writing where I was, here's the deal. I was a pro surfer for 5 years from 86 to 91. And the one thing I learned about pro surfing, and especially at that age, is that there was this inflated self-importance. Like being sponsored, going around the world, signing autographs, I just thought like this was a big deal. It just, in many ways, like the whole thing you're doing as a competitive athlete is you're trying to just boost your self-esteem as much as possible. Like it's healthy to be self-important. A kind of like narcissistic, one-dimensional focus on what you're trying to get is the name of the game, right? So that ended abruptly, and then I started writing, but I brought a little bit of that stuff with me. And right. I realized, like, in many ways, like, being a writer, or especially journalism, it's almost the exact opposite. It's about being curious about things outside of yourself. It's sort of, the more it's about you, the more, you know, you can very well be missing the point. Of course, you want to write with conviction, you want to have a voice, but... like to write a good, if I were writing a good profile of you, the more I kind of inhabit your life and get in there, the better, versus what in my early stages, it was sort of like my ego, like, how can I make sure I'm in this? So I think I definitely fell into that in the early bits, but so I would go for shock value. I would kind of like, I would want to like poke people. But then I slowly, I mean, just maturing and then life throwing me certain events, the stuff that's been received the best that I've written has been kind of writing from the heart, and it's been based upon personal experience, and that's the stuff that is connected. And then in the literary world, I mean, I lived in New York for about 11 years, and I was always trying to, like, I always felt like an outsider. I had this sort of imposter's complex. And I just felt like I'm this, you know, barefoot hedonistic beach kid that, like, moved to New York, and he's trying to break in with these dudes who went to Ivy League schools, and they've spent a lot more time reading great literature than I ever have.
Did you go back to school, sort of post-surf career?
Well, I did. And
to
I went,
get there?
Yeah, I went piecemeal, though. And to be truthful, I never had the money. Like, I looked into getting a degree, and I just couldn't afford it. So I went to Art Center, took great creative writing classes with a guy named Benjamin Weissman. I went to Santa Monica College, took great classes with Jim Crusoe there. When I moved to New York, I took classes at Pratt with a guy named Thad Ziolkowski. Studied screenwriting at the New School, but I was always just grabbing bits as I go. But I never had like the 50, 60, 70 grand to get an actual degree.
I mean, I think the first time, it's funny because I grew up in Santa Barbara in the 70s and 80s, but I didn't grow, and I was a total beach kid, but I didn't surf. You know, I didn't start surfing till my mid 20s or something. You know, I was like bodyboarded and body surfed or whatever, but that, so I wasn't engaged in that scene at that time. So I really know you from your writing.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I know your story of coming from pro surfing or whatever, but it's interesting. Like the first time I think you came on my radar, maybe Jack McCoy had mentioned your name to me or some, you know, something somewhere along the line, but which, by the way, I was happy to see you write about him in your book.
I love Jack.
Maybe
yeah.
Want to go watch some of his movies. But I think the first time that I encountered you as a writer was that really heavy story about your wife, you know, and going between Brazil and all
right,
that.
Right.
And I'm wondering if, and you kind of touched on this a second ago, but did that story, like, bring your writing to another level in terms of getting some exposure and that sort of thing?
Yeah, and to put it in really simple terms, so my wife passed away 6 years ago suddenly, and she was from Brazil, we'd lived in New York, we met in New York, and we had our 11 years together, mostly in New York with a lot of trips to Brazil.
Right.
And during, like, probably, like, from about 2005 till she passed away in 2013, for much of that time, I was trying to write this memoir about my life. And my agent at the time said, you know, you should write a memoir about your surfing life. And my brother died of a drug overdose. And it was trying to make all that work. And I was kind of, it wasn't working. And it was sending me into deeper levels of frustration. And I would go back and it was almost like writing further away from what it should be. And I was really kind of just brooding that, like, my writing dreams are not coming true the way I'd hoped. And I went through that really, really deeply. And then my wife died suddenly in 2013 in a cycling accident in Rio. And it ripped me open. But it also, I had this strange sort of like realization that, like, what a bummer. Like, the last 5 years of my wife's life was me not being fully there because I was bummed because my writing career wasn't going the way it was, because I didn't get the validation from the New York publishing world that I'd hoped for.
Right.
And I remember, like, and I'm simplifying to make the point, but I guess, like, I had this realization, like, I'm not going to live my life with that. Like, I don't, that kind of, and growing up in Southern California, and certainly I grew up in LA, like, we're careerists. We define ourselves via our careers. Like, that's what we champion. That's what we value. If you do it at a high level, you get the respect of your peers and you feel good about yourself. And if you're struggling at it, you can just beat the shit out of yourself. And I was doing that. And I felt like, I'm not going to live that way anymore. And I had this incredible sense of my own mortality, even though she died. It was like, and it was almost because I was semi-suicidal. It's like, I could be out of here really soon. I'm not grabbing the world very tightly right now. And hence, it sort of liberated me in some way. And I think, like, my writing voice became way more authentic and honest. Mm. And then I wrote, it took a while to do, but I wrote the piece about her and us and our kind of whole life together. And it resonated more than anything I'd written. And it was this weird irony of, like, I was trying to write a memoir, and I was trying maybe too hard. I was kind of like just overworking it and trying to make the sentences dazzling and blah, 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 blah. And then it was like, when I just sort of got out of my own way and just let it was, it's also a thing where it's like, you know, you get to a certain age and life just happens to you and stuff happens to you and you can't escape it. And it is difficult and painful, but it does, like, suddenly, like, I felt like I've got something to say. You know, that imposter complex was sort of gone, because, you know what, I've just been thrown like a heavy duty thing that I wouldn't wish it upon anyone, but I feel authoritative in talking about it because I experienced it.
Right. Yeah, that's a funny thing, the imposter complex.
Yeah.
I think we've all, you know, there's an insecurity attached to most creative people, it seems like, that probably all struggle with that in some way, even the most accomplished ones.
No, totally.
Have you expanded that story into a memoir? Do you have plans to put that out?
I think so. I think I want to, and I'm just trying to figure out exactly how to do it. You know, the piece that I'd written for the Surface Journal was like 6,000 words or something like that. So it's just a matter of sort of extending that and writing a lot of scenes. But I think that's something I want to do.
Because I kind of romanticize and I'm fascinated with California beach culture of the 70s and 80s because I was there. It was my childhood. It was what I grew up in. And I think it's an interesting time just historically, because you have, like, you know, it's the come down from the 60s upheaval and the Vietnam War, and you have like the... our country had had this massive infrastructure rebuilding and the New Deal and the Great Society, but that was all kind of getting a little shabby, but it was there. And then we went into Reagan era and cocaine. And I always wonder if it was like this for everybody's little California beach town, or if Santa Barbara was somehow different, but it just seemed like a wild time of teenagers, unsupervised, awash in drugs, kind of violent, but beautiful and just extreme at the same time. And, you know, that's sort of like my memory of it. But also with this, the surf of that era, like, I was sort of adjacent to it. I saw it. I was around it, but I wasn't a participant. So I think I kind of romanticized. So I would just love to, read what it was like for somebody that was sort of in the center of it.
Right. Well, I am writing right now an autobiographical novel about my own, and it's sort of what I tried to make work as a memoir, but I think it's now working as an autobiographical novel. But it's essentially sort of coming of age through surfing, and then my brothers, we got into punk rock, and that was great for a short period, and then that led to drugs, and then my brother died of a drug overdose. Mm. But it's, so it's sort of this bifurcation of, in many ways, like, mutual love of surfing, mutual love of punk rock, and then we bifurcate, and then punk rock leads him to drugs, and surfing leads me to competitive surfing, and the competitive surfing kind of buttressed me up. It, like, gave me discipline in this weird way, because you don't... I mean, now I guess you do, but at that time, as you well know, like, surfing was... It had this sort of countercultural association. You wouldn't think of, like, surfing as being this thing that would instill discipline upon a teenage kid.
Right.
But because I went the competitive route, and because I was at a certain time in history, which was Channel Island Surfboards, which were in Almeric in Santa Barbara.
Did you ride for Channel Islands?
I did, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I was part of the Channel Islands team workouts. And Al really, you know, and Tom Kern as well. Tom Kern was one of the early first guys that really brought this, like, athleticism to pro surfing. And so watching that, being a little bit younger, but watching that, it created this discipline, almost like a military-style discipline, that as my brother descended further and further, it was like, okay, this is the thing that's holding me together, and this is sort of my way of not falling into it myself, because right. I definitely recognize those qualities in that he had in myself as well.
It's interesting, you know, surfing kind of has that anyway. Like I always sort of think of like the pro surfing, that period when it got really into like having a personal trainer and everybody got really buff, sort of the Mick Fanning,
yes.
you know, model yeah. of being a pro surfer. You know, it came a little bit later. But there is something about surfing, about having to wake up at 5 a.m. when it's cold and damp outside and it's winter, and it's there's everything in your body is telling you to not go do this thing, but you still have to have that discipline of going out and doing it, you know, that it's sort of inherently has a discipline attached to it, you know, even for the people that aren't part of that athletic model.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I think it's interesting just looking at it, you know, having been in it for like 35 plus years or whatever, 40 years, it is more, it looks more and more that way now. I think I'll go surfing sometimes in the LA County area, and then it'll be like the Malibu High surf team down there, and it would be equivalent to like the basketball guys doing the drill in the gym or whatever.
Right.
But no, I think you're so right. And but there is, yes, the getting up early and then kind of being like glued to the ocean, like whatever, you know, you kind of are always, now you get it via Surfline, swell forecast, surf forecasting. Back in our day, it was like you had to just instinctually, intuitively, like know what the tides are, or, you know, read about the tides and then watch the swell and the wind and all that. So there is that discipline. But then the biggest thing that I came to realize, sort of inadvertently and sort of unfortunately, but after my wife passed away, like nothing felt good to me except going surfing. Mm. And I'd moved to New York almost to purposely not follow this surf trajectory, which is you basically follow good waves around your entire life and then you die, you know, like
yeah.
I saw so many of my peers doing that. And while I now think that is as like about as good a life as you can possibly have, I really questioned it. I just thought, you know, if I continue living on the beach and being in sunny locales, I will never like sit alone with the books that I need to do to sort of further myself as a writer. So moving to New York, I was conscious of trying to just like lock myself, like cloister myself off and learn and build that muscle of sitting alone in a room reading and writing. But when things changed in my life abruptly, I came back to California and I just sort of, I was so low functioning, I just thought, I'm just going to try to get by and try to be gentle on myself. My therapist was like, just be easy on yourself. So sometimes that meant drinking a bottle of wine sitting alone. Sometimes it meant getting stoned, and I wasn't a big stoner, but like at the time it was like I was trying everything, but surfing was the thing that just like made me happier than anything else.
It's interesting, because you know what you're talking about, there's the stereotypes of surfing that everybody knows, the Spicoli stereotype, oh, tasty wave, bro, that whole thing, you know, that's how surfing sort of generally treated in popular culture. Or there's like the MMA uber jock, like violent, you know, super competitor yeah. model as well. But the sort of lesser known but equally important part that maybe somebody like you or, you know, William Finnegan, there's not many people out there that represent this in literature or whatever, but is like the sort of the intellectual side of surfing, the deeper thinker, the people that shop at Mollusk and Pilgrim or whatever,
right?
Like
right.
That, sure. That type of surfer that I feel like is reflected more in your writing.
Yeah,
like were you? I just imagine you as a kid coming up in the surf world, which can be very conformist and very, you know, there's sort of like margins you have to exist in. Like, were you always a little left of center, or did you just kind of keep your thoughts to yourself?
I kind of kept my thoughts to
myself. Something must have driven you to the stuff you're talking about. It had to, in some way, always be there.
No, for sure it did. And you know, my father was a intellectual, and he was a writer, and he was also a publisher's representative, which meant he sold textbooks to all the colleges in Greater Los Angeles. So the dinner guests at our home growing up were, oh, this is Roger Moss. He's the psychology. He heads the psychology department at CSUN. Blah 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 blah. Like, it was always people who were sort of higher learning was like this highly valued in my household, and so that was there. But then I remember at one point when we got really into surfing, my dad said, you know, I grew up in Jersey, and there were seasons, and you know, 4 to 6 months a year, you were kind of summoned indoors, and that's where you read, that's where you watched movies on television, and you kind of cultivated this inner life and this intellectual curiosity. You kids, you guys just play in the sunshine 365 days a year. And it was almost like his, like he came to California because he loved California, but it was almost like he was seeing his kids get like to California. and all those things. And then he always gave me books. And then my oldest brother who passed away was really precocious intellectually. I mean, he was a real reader. And the punk rock stuff, which I imagine you would have gotten into too. I mean, there was so much.
Which can also be extremely conformist.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? When you stick out, it's which is ironic considering what it is.
No, I so get that. And it's funny you say that because I was just writing about that very thing. Like, you know, while punk seemed so revolutionary when I was 14 years old, I remember going to shows and it was like everyone's wearing the exact same shit.
Right.
But it definitely like, I think it was like a kind of starting point. It sort of like peaked intellectual, like the William Burroughs books. Naked Lunch was around at that time, right? There were like certain writers that sort of fell into the punk scene, and then if you were smart, as my oldest brother was, you sort of followed that. So he was following that, and I got a taste of that. But I did, I was like one of the many amateur competitive kids where we were all super serious, and there was this like jock element that was being introduced to surfing at the time via the NSSA. But I definitely had this sort of other inner life that I kept very, very quiet. And it was, to be honest, at this stage of my life, it's like the seedlings of depression, to be quite honest. I mean, it was really just like this sense of detachment. Like, right, I don't belong here. I don't know these. I'm playing this game. Just the very notion that I could frame it as a game, which I did a lot of.
Right.
One of my friends growing up had this great tattoo on his leg, if I remember correctly, and it was DPTG, don't play the game. And just the very notion of the game was, and that came from punk rock, obviously, but it was like this idea of like society is doing this stuff and you don't need to like be puppeteered into it all. You can be an individual, and that stuff, you know, was like very, very good. But it also made me feel like I was on the outside of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be connected to the imposter complex thing. You know, it's like those two things go hand in hand.
Yes, for sure.
There, you mentioned your dad, and I love that story. Standing naked. As a dad, I think about those kind of things all the time. But there's I forget exactly what he said, but it was like a great little life lesson from your dad, you know, stand in front of the girl naked so she could see the real you.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's thank you for bringing that up, because I value that so much. And it relates to what I was saying earlier about social media. And that is, when I was probably 18, 19, I was sponsored by Quiksilver. And there was a thing where amateur surfers could not receive money and retain their amateur status. I think it's still that way with the Olympics right now. But you could appear in ads. They did this thing with the amateur competitive body where you could appear in ads. So Quiksilver used some of the amateur guys in ads, and I started getting in ads. And for Quiksilver, before I'd actually turned pro and before I'd kind of gone out on my like odyssey of the pro tour. And so I was appearing in the magazines and you know, getting editorial and advertising. And one night I was sort of swaggering out the door to go with a friend to go to a party and chase girls, basically. And my dad could see like this sort of fake confidence or whatever, or this like, okay, Jamie thinks he's hot.
Right.
And he just stopped me and he said, you know, Jamie, when you're with a woman, you need to stand naked in front of her. It's not Jamie the pro surfer. It's not Jamie the guy that's going to go on the pro tour. You don't. The gist of it was sort of like, you're not like, that's not the card you play when you're intimate with someone. Like, it's got to be the deeper essence of you, i.e. standing naked. And no, I value that a lot, you know, and I...
Were you like, no, Dad, that's exactly how I'm going to get laid tonight.
Well, probably. I was thinking that. Yeah. No, and but the funniest part is that he used the term standing naked, which could be perceived like, oh, Dad, you and I are right in sync on this one. No, but it's funny because just thinking about where we started off this very conversation with the idea of like, sometimes it's great to meet someone without their reputation preceding them.
Right.
Knowing nothing about them. If it's a highly accomplished person, it's sort of like, well, let's get to know you as if I didn't know you better, and let's see what kind of person you are.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes like for the sake of journalism or doing an interview, you can probably, by researching who the person is, there are probably deeper questions you can ask. But it's interesting to see those exchanges with people that are like, there is this sort of sense of their true essence coming through.
What, you know, at that time when you were, like, say, a teenager and you're first coming up and kind of going down that pathway to becoming a pro surfer. I mean, what was surfing LA like? I mean, you know, I've lived here for a long time. I surf Malibu most of the time and Zuma and all those spots. Was it less crowded? Was it less of a hassle? Was it somehow, you know, like I said, I like to sort of romanticize that time of something that I missed, you know?
Yeah.
What, and of course, we all know about the era of like Mickey Dore and all that stuff when maybe those spots were uncrowded. But by the time you came along, what was it
right,
like?
No, it was such a golden time. I mean, I surfed my first contest in 1980, and it was actually at Third Point Malibu. And then I was, you know, deeply involved in the amateur scene till 1986 when I went on the tour. So for those 6 years, being in high school, surfing Malibu every day, first of all, like Third Point was such a better wave back then than it is now.
Really?
It was what we called the Kiddie Bowl, and it was this inside section. It was probably a little bit like the river mouth is at Rincon. It was a wave where you just bang the lip about four or five times.
Right.
And the biggest thing was...
What changed?
I think the bottom. You know, the creek that has been moved around, and they've done some conservation that may not have helped the surf with, you know, to keep the bird watchers happy, but right, the surfers right. have suffered. To be truthful, I don't even know. Like a lot of surfers have their ideas, but the creek has been sort of moved right. around. But I think it was mainly that the creek dropped off in a place that in the winter it moved a lot of stuff that created, it was always rock bottom, but like it made it like a really good shaped reef for the wave. So there was this thriving scene at Third Point, and First Point was always sort of longboarding. There was almost this delineation. If you ride a longboard, you surf First Point. If you ride a shortboard, you surf Third Point.
And which
you,
kind of still is the same today, right?
It's kind of still the same, yeah. But it was, and there was like a great scene where, you know, you could go down there and everyone knew each other and everyone was surfing really, really hard. Thruster was a new design. It was all about high performance. And like you said earlier, I mean, it was that period. I always think of like the Wall Street movie, the Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good.
Yeah.
There was this abundance and there was like, surfing was exploding. It was bright colors. People were getting paid more than they ever had.
The day glow era.
Yes, yes. And so there was this kind of like dangling carrot of like, there are high stakes here and you can make it happen. And all of us aspiring amateurs were going, okay, I want to do this. I want to get on tour and Quicksilver is going to sponsor me or, you know, whoever your sponsor was. And so there was that. So it was just... I mean, I think of it honestly, and I like the thing I remember most is just I would surf about three times a day, and I would have emotional stuff going on, but like physically, I felt so good because there just seemed like a lot of surf, and obviously it was like that time where you had a lot more time on your hands.
Right. Yeah. I try to tell my kids that all the time. Like, you don't understand. This is the only time in your life that you can go just sit at the beach all day and surf. Like you said, three times. Like,
yeah.
As soon as you leave home, that's gone forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That never comes back. What were those early days of the ASP and that whole thing of being sponsored by Quicksilver? And I assume you spent a lot of time in Hawaii. And was it the same back then? Like, was sort of as a young pro surfer, were you expected to spend like the whole winter over there and put in the time? And
yeah. Yeah.
Because wasn't there some sort of like the Quicksilver Black Shorts Association
yes.
thing? Like,
yes,
were you around for that
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, for right. sure. And Hawaii was, the North Shore was much heavier back then than it is now. I mean, it hadn't yet been gentrified the way it has. It was
right.
still kind of like ghetto-y. There were, you know, folks who lived in beachfront places that looked out to pipeline and they worked as waiters and, you know, you could still like live. You could still live kind of that surfer lifestyle.
I mean, not unlike California at that time, where like, you
yeah.
know, like the towns like Santa Barbara and Malibu and Oxnard Shores and stuff hadn't been turned into like playgrounds of hedge fund managers or whatever. You know, there's still
yeah.
like a working class population there.
Right. Yeah. So the North Shore had that vibe. But I think like the general vibe among the pros, it was interesting because there was the period of the 70s. It was sort of like everyone that came of age at that time and that was on the tour, the surfers they grew up. Admiring were generally like kind of great characters, and a lot of them were hard partiers, and you know, it was sort of like not cool to be a jock, right?
Mm.
But then it was turning jock, so there was almost this like, you know, devil on one shoulder and saint on the other, kind of like it was almost this tug of war between these two ideologies where like we were trying to be really, really serious, but and when I say like there was money in it, but nothing like there is now, so. In my case, like to be sort of thrown out on the world tour at age 19, there was, okay, I can really make this happen and make a great career and Quicksilver, if I make the top 30 or top 16 this year, I'll get a big boost in my retainer and I'll make some money, not so much to put money away and like be able to retire on it, but to live. But then the flip side of it, the sort of like the more like low hanging fruit version was, this may not last long, so let's have as much fun as possible. So whatever
you were aware of that at the time.
Yes, definitely. And like a lot of the Australians had that very strongly. I mean, there's this sort of like larrikin spirit, as they call it. You probably talked to Jack McCoy about this. His movies depict this. I mean, it was just much more of being, having fun and not being too serious. And I think like it's almost, and I'm making generalizations here, but like culturally, like the USA is so career driven, and it's about, you know, coming the idea of like you can invent yourself and you can make whatever you want. And the Aussie spirit, I think, is a little bit different. There's definitely more of a sense of fun. So I was totally influenced by a lot of the Australian guys who, interestingly, like we would have the Europe leg, and it would be three events in the southwest of France, then Spain, then Portugal, and it became just like a party every
and
night.
There were a lot more events, period, back then.
Yes.
Right?
And one year I remember, I think there was like 24 events on the calendar. So, I mean, you were always on the road, which with hindsight was really, really great, because I unlearned a lot of the things that I'd learned growing up in Los Angeles at that time. And so the further I got away from it, the more I'd come back here. And my contemporaries, the guys I went to high school with, would be going to college, getting throwing all their money into a cool car that's going to get them laid. And really like being very career driven, I guess, in this kind of statusy way. Right. And I think for better or for worse, my version was I got to just sort of gypsy around. I mean, the Pro Tour had a sort of somewhat of a rigor, and it definitely created this like traveling circus vibe. But it was also like I got to discover myself in ways that I never would otherwise. So a lot
and
of
get
it
get turned on all these other cultures, I would assume.
Exactly. Yeah. And it shaped my worldview, I guess, where I'd come back here and I'd feel yet again more disconnected from Los Angeles and the value system here. And it's like, okay, well, cool, that person has like a fancy car and a big house, but that doesn't really mean that much to me. And then my first girlfriend was from Australia, so I spent a lot of time in Sydney. So I really embraced at one point that just more of a, I don't know, less ambition.
Well, it's interesting, that thing you mentioned a minute ago about it, this might not last long, so I'm going to enjoy it while I'm here. Like, what was the shelf life in those days of a pro surfer? I mean, it was like you didn't have Kelly Slater's surfing at almost 50 years old or on the pro tour. I imagine it was a very,
very,
short
very
run.
Short. Yeah, interestingly, like in the 90s, Aki, I think, was the oldest to win a world title on his comeback, and he was in his early 30s. But no, I mean, pretty much when you were like 26, 27, it was sort of like you should be thinking about plan B kind of thing.
Right.
And my career went till I was 25. And I'm kind of glad, I'm glad I had a moment where I was like, I could try to keep kicking on, but I just sort of knew I had to face the inevitable, which is just trying to figure out what I'm going to do after that.
You know, so many people, athletes of any kind, there's some, oftentimes post their career, their athletic career, can be cynical and bitter about the sport that they were in. But you don't seem to have that at all. I mean, you seem to, you know, still like you get a lot of joy out of surfing. But in the early days when you first quit the tour, did you go through a phase like that?
Absolutely, I did. Well, it was twofold. The one thing was, so I did 5 years on the tour. I kind of had like this last, not even the whole season, but even like the last few legs of the event, Quicksilver said, like, you got to deliver some results for us. It was, I think, November was when contracts came up, and there was a Brazil leg. And it was sort of like, okay, I need to just, like, hit it out of the park here and come back, and then I can justify and get back on my retainer. Or if I do poorly, I won't be paid next year, and then I've got to face the music. And so I went to Brazil, and like the first day I got there, a friend of mine had some acid that he'd brought over. We did acid. I mean, I kind of did this great self-sabotage that I didn't know at the time. I rationalized it all. Okay. So like
if you had only just microdosed, you would have been way ahead of the curve.
Totally. I mean, that's how it went. Like literally, I did acid the day before the event in Rio that I could have redeemed myself, and then I got a 17th. I lost to Tom Curran. I didn't do horribly.
Right. No shame in losing to Tom Curran, I suppose.
No, actually, Tom Carroll. Sorry.
Tom Carroll.
Yes, yes.
Well, same.
Yeah. But, and then the next event was in Sao Paulo, and I think I got a 17th there as well. And then I kind of knew my career was over, and I got my like $350 prize money, and a friend of mine was getting some cocaine, and I said, can I get some cocaine too? And I got the cocaine, and I literally just like snorted it on this long taxi ride to the airport in Sao Paulo. And then I really had kind of a breakdown. I really fell apart.
What, you went and jumped on a plane? Because that sounds like the worst possible situation.
No, it was bad.
To finish your cocaine and then get on a long plane ride. Like, and, what could be worse?
Well, then it was just like a lot of beer and a lot of visiting the restroom as well. No, it was terrible, actually. I kind of really did. I did this like self-sabotage thing. It was sort of like, you know, maybe this is addicts might do this as they're like, they're very nearing the bottom and it's like, okay, I'm going to really bottom.
Right.
It was sort of like, I'm going to just like plunge myself down to where it is like irreversible.
Right.
And I sabotaged more than just my career. I sabotaged my relationship at the time. And then I had to like find my way back. And, but what was interesting is like, I'd gone from, you know, signing autographs in Rio to like 2 weeks later, I was living in Sydney because I'd based myself in Sydney. I was working at a surf shop. And working at a surf shop, with all due respect, wonderful thing. But at that time, it just felt like such a letdown from what I'd been doing, this exciting life. And then I ran into a friend who was an editor of a surfing magazine, and he said, I actually need an associate editor, and I've got a little money budget. Do you want the job? And I said, yes, yes, yes. So two things happened. One, I had to go interview the very surfers that I'd been competing against 3 months earlier. And that was a real ego thing. And I say that, like, now I'm... don't think that way, but at that time it was this weird like rigid hierarchical thinking of a 20, you know, being in your 20s, where it's like, so you're the star now and I'm like the minion who's like got a tape recorder in your face.
I
we live in a different world now, and of a certain age, it's sort of like being curious about people is a wonderfully valued thing. So there was that. But then the other thing that happened was, when I was so determined to be a good surfer that I kind of put these blinders on, and a lot of the sort of, for lack of a better description, like intellectual curiosity, cultural curiosity, wanting to grow outside of just surfing had been sort of dormant in me. And as soon as I stopped being a pro surfer, it was like these blinders came off, and it was just like, oh, there's this incredible world. There's like, and I was living in Sydney, and Sydney was perfect because it's a smaller city, but it was sort of like I started running with people as far from the surf world as I could. Mm. And I met like musicians, writers, poets, kind of really odd, like urban characters that never kind of leaked down to Malibu when I was growing up to some degree, but it was like, now I get to actually explore this stuff. So that was like the biggest revelation. And then,
do you think if your friend hadn't offered you that job, was writing even on your radar at all?
No, it was, because as I said, my dad always gave me books, and then I got in this habit where whenever, you know, the tour was like this combination. I'm sure you relate to this. I would either be with all my pro surfer buddies, and it would be like this frat boy kind of thing, and you were kind of like, you were supported by this group, or there were many times where like I would board a plane at LAX and then 30 hours later step off in Durban, South Africa, after a long stopovers where I had to sleep on my board bag in Heathrow. And in those like long, long plane flights, I kind of learned how to be alone, and I read and I wrote. And I literally, in that insanity of like fidgetiness and stuck in an economy class seat on a plane, I would read the book that my dad said, you should check this out, Jamie, because you're going to England and this, or South Africa, this book's about this. And then I always kept journals. So it was like I was just starting out, but there was definitely like, oh, this interests me. And in some weird way, all these writers, like to sort of understand this change, this transformation of like my first dream of being a pro surfer is now over and I've got to go find my way. These writers I read, like, almost grabbing aphoristic sentences. Henry Miller, who was, you know, who'd left New York and gone to live in Paris, the idea of being an expat. I read him and it romanticized my expat status of living in Sydney. And while mine was way less exotic and interesting than his, I kind of like, oh, the magic of language. Look at how it's like doing this beautiful thing, but it's also like helping me understand how I feel.
So what is your relationship to pro surfing now? Like, how engaged in it are you?
You know, I watch some of it. I love it. I love Kelly Slater. I love John Florence. There's a lot of it that I just, having been in it for so long and kind of knowing everyone personally, there was this, I was sort of, I was invested in a way that I'm not anymore because I just don't know a lot of the kids.
Right.
To call them kids is funny. But, but I mean, I love the high performance element. The thing that I find, and this sounds ridiculous, but I've realized, like, watching pro surfing events consumes a lot of time. It's not like watching a baseball game or a basketball game where, right. you know, there's a couple of hours and I move on from it. It's days. And it's not only the watching, but it's the obsessing.
Right.
And often, I mean, I'm thankful, but I have enough stuff that I have to write every day that I kind of just can't. I can't, like, wake up and try to find out what the contest is doing because it'll just derail my day.
Right. Suck you into it.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, there's been so much talk over the years. I mean, this has been the talk the whole time there's been a pro tour of how to sort of package it for non-surfers, for casual sports fans or whatever. And I know that gets debated, you know, the sort of the merits of what the WSL is doing and how sort of squeaky clean and false positive the coverage tends to be and all that stuff. What's your take on that? Like, do you, you just hear a lot of chatter about sort of the surf tour's imminent demise, how it's just a money loser, how whatever it is that they're doing isn't working.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, reaching the people they want it to reach, and that it's all sort of being kept afloat by, what's his name, Dirk Ziff, one gazillionaire that underwrites the whole thing.
Yeah.
Do you think, where do you see it headed, and what could or should, or do you think would be good to replace it?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, sometimes I will go to the webcast, and the first, like, car ad that you have to watch to get into it will already be turning me off. It'll be hyperbolic. It'll just feel way over the top, and I'll just go, God, this is surfing now. This is so exactly the opposite of what drew me to surfing in the first place.
Right. But then there's, like, the commentary. You know, it's like I was watching the Portugal contest that, you know, yesterday or whenever it was, and I don't even remember who it was. One of the lesser known guys surfing like a, you know, foot high slop and just doing a couple of turns or whatever. It was like nothing. And the commentators go, oh my God, that was amazing. You know, blah, blah, blah. That whole thing.
Yeah.
I know it rubs me the wrong way. It seems to rub a lot of people the wrong way. It seems like they're like, you know, they alienate the sort of core surf audience in a way that they probably shouldn't.
I know. It's interesting that. And I think, and I sometimes go, okay, well, I'm of a certain age, like we talked about earlier, sort of coming. I started surfing in the very, very late 70s, but the 70s decade, from what I know of it in researching, it was about understatement. It was about keeping everything low-key. So it was the antithesis of, like, talking it up. And there's a lot of sort of talking it up of what you're referring to. When it feels like I'm watching a football game, when it feels like Super Bowl magnitude, it turns me off, quite right. honestly.
Especially if you're watching people surf in waves that, like, I would be comfortable in.
Yeah.
That's the big turnoff for me. I want to see those guys surf in waves that would scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, sure. But then at the same time, I mean, they've added a lot more to it than the stats that they bring to it, the board that the person's riding in the heat. I mean, all that stuff, I think, helps to keep you interested and engaged. It's just a tricky one because, I don't know, sometimes when it feels like it's being dressed up to sort of, like, there's a conscious attempt to get this out to the masses, I just think that's almost like inherently a bad motivation. You know, it's
right.
It's like the more, it's almost like the more surfing just leans back into what it is, and obviously what it is a big question, but the more it feels like what surfing is, the better, and whether that has a huge audience or not is another story. But it's, you know, it's like, this is like corporate America here. I had this great conversation with a friend yesterday. We were talking about, like, surf brands, right? And, like, a lot of surfers started clothing companies. Quicksilver was founded by surfers. And probably as they were building that up, I was going to say growing it, but that sounds like corp speak. But as they were building that up, they probably loved it and everything was their lifestyle. And then as soon as it went IPO and they had their sort of quarterly numbers to hit, it changed.
Right.
And I think, like, to some degree, maybe there's a parallel there with surfing is just gone for this mass appeal. And as a result, it inevitably, there are bits where it just doesn't feel like it's the real thing anymore. It feels like it's being compromised or like dressed up and meant to be. It's like a hard sell.
It's interesting. As I understand it, the surf industry has never really recovered from the 2008-2009 economy
crash. I think so.
And so I wonder, you know, what is there a lot of money in pro surfing at this point? If you removed the one guy that's sort of underwriting the whole thing,
right?
Is it just like this house of cards that would all fall apart? You know, like
yeah. I don't know. I've heard that. I mean, I've definitely heard people say that, but I'm not in it enough to really say for sure.
I mean, have they ever reached out to you? It seemed like, you know, somebody with your take on surfing or your voice would be, that'd be like an influence that would be helpful to their brand. I mean, as much as I realize that they probably don't see it that way, but have they ever reached out to you?
No, they haven't. And I'm not. I mean, I guess like the thing that I've learned is the thing that I try to adhere to is just utter honesty.
Right.
And so I don't know if that's, I don't know.
Wouldn't that be so great, though, if you tuned in and they're like, holy fuck, they got to surf in this slop.
Yeah, this is absurd.
This sucks. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think like the surfer will go, yay.
Yeah, I know. It could be effective. I mean, you know, Barton Lynch, I always enjoy listening to. He brings a sort of real honesty to it.
Right. Okay, I got one question, because I read Becoming Westerly, and I think in the book, I know there was a documentary being made. Did that ever come out? Because I've looked for that from time to time, and I can't find it on any of like the Netflixes of the world.
Yeah, no, we're right in the very end. Finally, it's taken so long.
Okay.
It's probably I'm not giving anything away, but Westerly has gone back to being Peter.
Ah.
So
I mean, does it blow the whole climax of the movie? Like, because I thought in the book that was no longer possible.
Well, here's the thing. It isn't possible. It isn't possible in that sense.
Right.
The surgery happened.
Right. For people listening that don't know the story, Peter Droon was, you know, legendary pro surfer from back in the day, from Australia, who transitioned to had a sex change.
Right. Yep. And now has gone back to living as a man. And so it's interesting because it's been a long time editing the film, and we were trying to sort of find the end, and then this change happened, and we realized like, oh, okay, maybe there was a reason why we couldn't figure out how to finish the film, and so we went back to Australia and interviewed him, and got the whole story, and now we're just finishing that right now.
It was a really interesting. I loved that book.
Thanks.
But it's an interesting, like, I didn't find, like, I didn't like him.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Which is a tricky thing to pull off when I'm sure as a writer,
yes,
to keep people interested. Because he was, to me, and maybe it was just me, there was just he was so, like, just the ultimate narcissist. He just sounded like I felt your pain trying to deal with him.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
it just drove me crazy, but I loved the book.
Yeah. No, it was really, really tough that. It's that interesting thing, though, that as we know, it's like sometimes people's best qualities like are paired with their sort of worst qualities.
This
person who could be so charismatic and so fun would also have this need for attention and kind of just taunting and poking at. I mean, really just really difficult to be around. But then just when I would hit my breaking point with Westerly kind of being difficult, she would do something incredibly interesting and charming, and I'd come to realize, I mean, it's just like a lot of really talented genius people, like that.
You don't necessarily want to have to hang out with them or rely on them for anything.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you get back to the surf, man. It was really good to talk to you today. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Chris. It's great to talk.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, you know, there's one thing I did forget to bring up. You know what made me so happy was in that story straight out of Santa Ana was that you name-checked Johnny Thunders and Hanoi Rocks.
Oh, yeah, I like Hanoi Rocks.
Never happened in surf literature, ever.
Right, well, I know
Hanoi Rocks is like my favorite thing ever. That was like the band that changed my life.
No, and I know
Johnny Thunders, too.
You know? I've noticed that. But, no, I got really into Hanoi Rocks at one point, actually. And I was really into the New York Dolls. And that was my brother. You know, it's sad to say, but, like, my brother was drawn to the movie Christiane F. There was like this heroin culture.
If you look at it,
like the through line, there was a book called A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich at that time. Like there was so much of that era that like the commonality among it all was heroin. But
right.
New York Dolls got a lot of play when I was growing up in high school.
Interesting.
And then Hanoi Rocks, and there was that sort of glam thing.
Yes. Hanoi Rocks, to me, one of the most misunderstood bands ever. They get lumped in with like butt rock hair metal stuff, and they like just really weren't that.
Yeah, I thought they were brilliant. I mean, I remember I listened to them tons. I listened to them while I was on the tour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good to hear. And remind me someday to tell you about my failed tour with Andy McCoy, the guitar player.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of heroin.
Right. Right. Wow.
All right, that was Jamie Brissick on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com because I am going to put up a bunch of links to articles, books, blog entries, all sorts of stuff that Jamie Brissick has written over the years, as well as the link to his website so you can check out where he's at, what he's doing, buy his book, all that sort of thing. And maybe someday you too will get to surf with Jamie Brissick in Malibu somewhere. That's it for this week. Be back in a couple of weeks with another wonderful interview. I don't know which one I'm going to post, but I have a shit ton of them in the can, so it'll be something great, I promise. Okay, adios amigos, happy Thanksgiving, and I'll see you soon. This is Chris Shiflett, over and out.